listening to The Radiator 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you're going to hear an interview with Roberta Gately. A nurse, humanitarian aid worker, and writer, Roberta Gately has served in third world war zones ranging from Africa to Afghanistan. She has written on the subject of refugees for the Journal of Emergency Nursing and the BBC World News Online. She speaks regularly on the plight of the world's refugees and displaced. She's the author of two novels. The Library Journal called her first novel Lipstick in Afghanistan, an informative glimpse into the lives of women in challenging times. Her latest book, which is the book that we discussed for this interview, is The Bracelet, published by Gallery, an imprint of Simon & Schuster. In The Bracelet, Boston nurse Abby Monroe and New York Times reporter Nick Sinclair find themselves entrenched in the middle of a human trafficking ring overseas when Abby realizes she may have witnessed the murder of a Pakistani woman by a high-ranking official. She and Nick must break the story before she becomes the next casualty. An emotional and powerful story, The Bracelet expertly navigates readers through the rich and complex Middle Eastern cultural landscape. When I spoke with Roberta Gately in January, I began by asking her about her background and how she came to write The Bracelet.
Well, I'm a nurse, a humanitarian aid worker, and an author. My first novel, Lipstick in Afghanistan, came out 2 years ago.
Uh-huh.
The Bracelet evolved. It evolved actually from that opening scene, which I dreamt. Once I decided who the victim would be, it initially was going to take place in Africa. But once I started to research human trafficking and the issues, it became clear that the people were mostly trafficked from the East. That's where the highest numbers are.
Uh-huh.
India, Pakistan, Nepal. And so I changed the setting of my story and dove in again. The research was stunning to me, even though I'm a nurse and an aid worker and I understand the crises and the issues of separated women and children, during horrific early times and crises. I had no idea that it was ongoing and that people were such at risk all of the time.
Yeah. Did you spend time in Pakistan?
I've spent a lot of time in Pakistan. The place that I've gone to most often is Afghanistan. And Pakistan has always been the route into or out of Afghanistan.
Okay. You mentioned the research and just being struck by how the human trafficking is ongoing. I was really struck by the information about how very often this starts because families sell their children or sell family members. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And as terrible as that sounds to us, because we're sitting here in our comfortable heated homes with full bellies from breakfast and maybe appointments to go to and cars to jump into. In much of the world, people live literally by the seat of their pants.
Mm-hmm.
And in places like the deepest rural parts of India or Pakistan, where they often don't have enough food to last the family for a whole day, money is scarce. The only thing that they do have is the resource of their children and the hope that their kids can work. In places like Pakistan and India, there are brick factories, which are horrific jobs, where kids can go. But imagine, if you will, that so your family is, you have nothing, you live in a mud hut if you're lucky, and then something terrible happens, either a flood or part of your country is at war or there are bandits around and somebody shows up and says he can find a job for your child or your daughter. And not only that, but here's some money. Who wouldn't think, if you're hopeless, who wouldn't grab at that little kernel of hope? So I think although it's easy to say, oh, they sell their kids, I, it's such a tough situation to be in.
Right. And you think most of these people are doing this with a sort of a deep-seated hope that this is actually a real opportunity for their child to have a job and escape the poverty?
I do. I don't think, you know, certainly there is always that little kernel of evil in some places. And women and children are the least valued in many parts of the world. But I still do believe that when they give their daughters or their children up for money, for a fistful of rupees, that they believe that something good will come of it for their child.
Yeah.
And for a kid who's never been beyond her own village, and for a family who hasn't, chance to maybe see the world, and we all have dreams, even, you know, especially maybe kids who are over there.
Did you meet some of the people who had been involved with this and take down some of their stories as you were doing your research?
No, I actually, and that was, initially I had planned to do that, and I went to a group called notforsale.org, fabulous, fabulous group. They do wonderful stuff. And they were going to get me in touch with some people, and they did get me in touch with one woman. And she had been trafficked domestically, and as tragic as her story was, it wasn't quite what I wanted. Mm-hmm. And she wanted to introduce me to people, but she was adamant, this victim, that I tell victims' real-life stories and use their names. And I tried to explain that it was a novel, and then I thought, it's better for me just to do my research as an outside stranger than to get close to women and then disappoint them that I can't tell their story exactly.
Right, yeah. Now, in the early part of the book, Abby, your main character, sees a woman fall to her death from a balcony in Geneva. And then later in the book, we learn through her friend or, you know, a man that she meets, Nick, that in the world of human trafficking, women who are trying to fight their kidnappers will often jump or be pushed from upper floors of buildings or from balconies. Is that true?
That's absolutely very true. And I first learned that firsthand as an aid worker. I went into Iraq. We went into Iraq right behind the soldiers. And we had to wait in Kuwait to get word that we could go in. And when I was in Kuwait, I was struck by a country that is so rich, none of the regular work is done by Kuwaitis. It's all outsiders.
Mm.
And I read, not just once, several times in newspapers about foreign women who had, and the newspaper always reported, jumped to their death from a balcony.
Mm.
And then there was on the internet once a little story about had these women jumped or had they been thrown or pushed because their lives were so horrible. And then when I was there, I read a little bit more about that and was horrified that happened.
Yeah. And so do you think that was the little kernel that led to the dream that you had that led to the book?
Probably, because I also run.
Oh, okay.
And when I had that dream of the very first of that scene, it was very real to me, just mm-hmm. as it was to Abby when she woke up later after dreaming it. It was so real to me that I got up and wrote it down. And it really took a few minutes for me to, you know, calm down and realize it was a dream. It didn't happen.
Wow. And that was such an incredibly workable way to get into the novel. You know, Abby, in her American mindset, which we all have as we start to read the book, goes out for a run, and she's running, and then she's sort of like these worlds collide, where she's in Geneva, but then all of a sudden something from another world is happening, and then the next scene she's actually going to Peshawar. I liked also that she had worked in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. Well, she had been in New Orleans before Katrina, and then after Katrina, you say in the book, Abby didn't stay. She has some guilt about this. And then in deciding that she's going to Pakistan, she says this time she would stay. And I liked that. I liked that you set up her resolve right from the beginning, so we sort of know that she's in it for the long run. And so I wondered if you could talk a little bit about tying those two events together, Katrina and then her decision to go to Pakistan and the next phase of her life.
Mm-hmm. Well, my brother lives in New Orleans.
Oh, my sister lived there during Katrina.
Well, my brother actually is a reserve helicopter pilot. He was actually in Iraq during Katrina.
Oh, wow.
But his wife and family were there. So I was there not long after, a few months later, and I was struck by the desolation that still existed even 6 months later.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that really stayed with me, and I thought, God, in the U.S. for it to be like this. And I also worked in a children's program then, and some children who had been, they and their families had been relocated to Boston were in the program. So I was very interested in what had happened and the long-term effects. And as a nurse, I knew that many hospitals, when they were flooded and they got the patients out, they just shut down. So there weren't jobs for a lot of people. And I could imagine somebody just saying, let's go, let's get out of here.
Yeah.
And then feeling great guilt about it as you come to the realization that you've abandoned your heritage.
Yeah, yeah. My niece, my sister's family lived there through Katrina, and then my niece was graduating from high school and decided to go to college out of state, and was given a great deal of negative feedback from her friends and neighbors about leaving. You know, you can't leave. We need you here now, you know, and it was really interesting to me that was, you must stay here. You have to help us because we've had this terrible thing happen. So I thought that was a very believable moment where Abby felt so guilty about having left.
Oh, good. Actually, my sister-in-law didn't like Abby, and I think because of that. My sister-in-law lived in New Orleans, and I think she felt that a character shouldn't do that. But in real life, we do that. We make mistakes. We're not perfect.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. When she does get to Pakistan, she quickly meets this woman that she's going to be interacting with, although not necessarily working very closely with, Najila. Am I saying that right?
Yes, you are.
Yeah, okay. And I loved this sentence. This is only on page 38, and yet it set up something very eerie. It just stood out on the page. Najila seemed like the type of woman who always got her way. This sentence comes in, even though we're being told that she's a very nice woman and that they get along well and that they're going to be fast friends. I mean, right away, Najila's like, oh, you're going to be my best friend. And yet there's this sentence, she seemed like the type of woman who always got her way. Were you trying to insert a little foreshadowing there or a little doubt in our minds?
A little doubt, because I think that we all meet people who are almost too sweet or too much, and there's a little seed of doubt in the back of our minds.
Yeah.
And for me, Najila was that.
Yes, absolutely. The other thing about Najila that gave me pause, although it's very, you know, it's easy to judge from a distance, as you said when we were speaking earlier about people selling their children, but she has a very chilly attitude toward the downtrodden. And I know you're developing a unique character here, but you see this kind of emotional reserve, this emotional remove between rich and poor everywhere, you know, here as well. I was wondering if you found that there was a certain remove that more comfortable wealthy people built into their attitude toward the refugees when you were working as a humanitarian aid worker.
I don't meet very many wealthy people over there. But I certainly, when I speak here, and it's not just wealthy, I think that it cuts across lines, that there are some people, and I've learned it publicly, when I'm speaking, I can see eyes glaze over in an audience. And I know even among my friends, some people just think, it's another world, it's another life, don't tell me about it.
Mm-hmm.
So for Najila, that's not so unusual. For her, it was a little over the top sometimes. But she's definitely, and I wanted her to be an Afghan refugee only in the technical sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that she's not alone. There are people from third world nations who live beautiful lives all over the world. And just because somebody is an Afghan or a Pakistani or an Indian doesn't mean they're living this miserable, terrible life.
No, it's more like they're expats, sort of.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
In their own place. Well, once Abby gets to work in her new world, we are introduced to the to the protection tent. I wonder if you can talk about the protection tent and how this came to be a part of this book.
Well, the protection tent is something, not necessarily, it's not always a tent, sometimes it's a little hut, but in at least with the International Rescue Committee and with most aid groups around the world, in the first days of a crisis, people are most vulnerable. They're most vulnerable from illness, from death, from attacks, if it's a war issue, or from other health issues, if it's a natural disaster. But they're also at risk because women and children are often separated from their families. Mm-hmm. In a time of crisis or escape, people find themselves alone. So the protection tent is set up just to try and help people get back together so that people can come and say, I'm from this village, is there anybody here? Take my name. For the book, for the visual aspect, I had pictures. In real life, these people don't have cameras, so there really aren't pictures.
Right.
I actually took that image from 9/11.
That's
the image
what it,
of walls with the pictures.
That's what it reminded me of, absolutely.
Yeah, that whole image has stayed with me all this time, and I wanted to have that kind of strong image in the story.
Yeah. I've never heard afterwards if anybody did find their loved ones through the pictures that were posted after 9/11. I don't know.
Yeah, I haven't heard either, which I think is sad because I suspect that if there had been even one story, we would have heard it.
I would think so. As I was reading the book, I found myself wondering, would the UN actually send such an unprepared worker as Abby into a region like Peshawar? You know, she has very little training. She is a nurse, but she doesn't have any idea what she's about to come up against, and she doesn't have a lot of cultural preparation. She doesn't know a lot about the region. Would that happen?
You know, something probably not, but that's why I made it such a crummy job.
Okay.
A lousy stipend and vaccine statistics, because a job like that would have very few people applying for it.
Yeah, okay.
And she applied again and again and again. And part of that is that the online application system for the UN really does weed out the lesser determined applicants. It's a tough system just to get through. Did they get my application? Did they? So while it isn't entirely likely, considering the job, in the struggle she had just to get her application in, it's not so unlikely either.
Okay. All right. Okay. I was just wondering. I was a little worried. I loved, this is just sort of a light moment. Abby meets this reporter named Nick. At first, they do not at all hit it off. They don't like each other at all. And he's talking about why he finds the region so fascinating. And I love the moment where she says, well, then why don't you just write a mystery novel about it? I thought that
was funny. Oh, I'm glad you picked up on that. I loved that, too.
That was great. Okay, I wonder if you can talk, from a writer's perspective, talk a little bit about introducing characters into a storyline to create intrigue. I mean, this is a mystery novel, but also to keep things real and to keep the plot possible and believable and within the realm of what's actually, you know, possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, for me, I'm an unprepared writer. I'm a nurse and an aid worker. I've been writing since I was little, but I don't have any formal preparation.
Mm-hmm.
So for me as a writer, I do it as a reader. I think even as a little kid, I was a reader first. You know, we read early. We got our library cards early. Books have always been a big part of my life. And when I was little, I started to write stories. So I hope that I create the kind of stories that I would want to read.
Mm-hmm.
But it's true, creating a character who's perfect for the plot and who has enough quirks or subtleties to keep readers interested is a challenge. I'm working on my next novel now. And it is. You have to create people who fit. And part of the way that I do that is I think of myself as an observer, no matter where I am.
Mm-hmm.
At work, at the gym, at the supermarket. I always actually have notebooks with me. But I really watch people. I watch people in line at the supermarket. I see what they're buying. just the way they move their items. When they're on the their cell phone, who are they talking to? What's their expression? And you can really pick up bits and pieces of characters just from doing that.
It's struck me that part of the enjoyment of reading this book or any book really is trying to discern, you know, who will be helpful overall, you know, who will be dangerous, you know, mm-hmm. can I trust Abby's first impressions of people, or is she making a mistake here? And people who start out seeming one way can turn out to be something very different. Did you have fun sort of playing with that?
I did. And especially with a character like Najila, who mm-hmm. I think even at the end, we can't be sure
right.
who she is. And part of Najila, the book was really essentially written, and I was redoing things. And I was in New York to meet with Simon and Schuster. And I was in Central Park with a friend, and I saw Najila. I was dumbfounded. The character that I had created in my mind and on paper was walking in Central Park, smoothing her hair.
Wow.
She was a beautiful Pakistani woman. Yeah, I wanted to follow her. But I just actually pulled out my notebook and started writing a little bit of her description. She was so self-absorbed.
Mm.
And beautiful, and when she started to smooth her hair, that's when I went back and made sure Najila did it as well. I'm always on the lookout. We see our characters everywhere.
Yeah, yeah, that's great that you would have seen her and thought, that's her.
Oh my God, I'll never forget it. And the friend that I was with said, what is it? And I said, it's Najila, and he hadn't read any of this stuff yet. And he said, who?
Yeah. Well, and so the funny thing is, so often I think that writers will see somebody out in the world and think, oh, that's a really interesting looking person. I want to write about somebody who looks like that or acts like that. But that you had already created a character and had created somebody without seeing this woman first. And then she, yeah, that's really interesting that she just made you think, oh, that's her.
Yeah. And that's the first time that that's ever happened to me, that I was so struck.
Yeah. As I was reading The Bracelet, I made a note to myself, when Abby decided to take out her notebook and actually write out all of her memories of seeing a woman plunge to her death from a balcony in Geneva, and mm-hmm. and then write out her dreams that had sprung from this experience,
mm-hmm.
this felt to me like a turning point in the book. It just felt like, okay, here's where we're going from all the lead up to where things start to be, you know, there's more at stake now. It's all written down. And it really made me think about the power of writing something down and having it physically present in the world. I enjoyed that moment in the book, and I wondered if you saw that as well as a turning point or an important moment.
Oh, and I'm glad that you caught that. Very few people have mentioned that. For me, it really was, because writing it down, you're right, makes it real and creates it forever. So when your memory fades, or when you think, does it sparkle with rubies? Or if you write it down, you'll know.
Yeah.
I think that writing it down is like the window to our memories and the images that we've seen.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny though too, because when you write it down, all of a sudden you contain it within the world of words, and so it gains permanence and maybe loses a little bit of that ability to change and transform in our minds. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. It definitely does.
We talked a little bit about human trafficking before, but I don't want to just slip into the novel and not talk about the reality a little bit more. In an author's note at the end of the book, which I was really glad you included, you give some more hard facts about human trafficking, and you actually suggest that it may be the fastest growing industry in the world, is one way that you put it. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about it and give us some of the statistics.
Yeah, the statistics of human trafficking are actually mind-numbing. Just really sobering facts. It's of all of the illegal trades, human trafficking is the third most lucrative, behind only arms and drugs. and it brings in an estimated $32 billion tax-free dollars a year. And the thing about human trafficking is that there are endless resources to keep that business fueled and going. For drugs and arms, you have to, you know, cultivate the drugs, make the arms. For human trafficking, the resources are always there. I think that if the world doesn't stand up and do something, it will be number one in illegal trades in no time, which I think is so sad.
Yeah.
But I think that it's gone unnoticed by us, and not because we're bad, but because it's not something that's been on the tip of our tongue, and we haven't thought to think that that woman maybe at the nail salon is a trafficking victim who does nails during the day and is forced into sexual business at night. I think it's just incredible. And the numbers are awful, between 700,000 and 4 million people. Mm-hmm. And when you think of those numbers, it's terrible. And people are afraid, the victims are afraid to come forward. Oftentimes, although not always, they're undocumented. But even if they're American citizens, to their mind and to their traffickers, they've committed crimes.
Right.
So there's that fear. If I come forward, I will be in trouble. And I'm sure that's what their traffickers tell them. Yeah. And even recently, in the federal government, in a great act of foresight, about 10 years ago, enacted a federal trafficking protection law. But we don't hear about it much. You know, it kind of was lost in the horde of statutes and bills and laws. And many states have started them now. Massachusetts enacted a human trafficking law last year, and there have been a handful of arrests. And when there have, we hear a few relevant facts about the traffickers, the criminals, and we hear how many victims there were, and then that's it. We never hear the story again, and we never hear the victim's stories. So for me, I hope that that's what the bracelet does as well, tells the victim's stories.
Right.
And actually, this stuff, as an addition, I finished a book called Mariah's Story, a novella, which is based on, which is actually the story of one of the trafficking victims from the bracelet. Mm-hmm. And it's her story, told in the first person from when she was a little girl, from the time before she was trafficked, and her life. So we really get a glimpse into who Mariah was. And Simon & Schuster, at some point soon, I hope, will be releasing that as a pretty inexpensive ebook as a promotion.
Oh, okay.
And I'm really pleased with that. I want people to see who these victims are. It's so easy for us, and not out of cruelty or selfishness, but it's so easy for us here to sit and think, oh, they're so different from us. But they aren't. I think around the world, we all want the same things.
Yeah.
Want
yeah.
good lives and full bellies and nice homes and someone to love us. I think that the things that are alike about us far outweigh our differences.
What about U.S. involvement in this? Like, to what extent are United States citizens unwittingly sometimes involved? Like, you mentioned the nail salons. So in the city, or I don't know if the nail salons all over the country, or if it's mainly in the bigger cities, might have people working for them that aren't there by choice. Are there other areas that I think about the sex tourism trade. Is that part of this whole thing as well?
Well, part of it, and I got a lot of my numbers from the Polaris Project, which is based in D.C. and does great work in this area. And they say that there, in every single state, there have been trafficking incidences and arrests. Mm. And sometimes it's in a seemingly innocuous house in a middle-class suburb that people finally got suspicious about because there were so many cars there at night. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that it's really a brothel. And that it's trafficking victims who were forced into prostitution there at night and who live there. They were brought there under cover of darkness, and they lived under cover of darkness. So I think that they are among us, and it's hard, because we don't know what to look for, it's hard to know who's a good guy and who's a bad guy.
Right.
And it's not because we're bad or lazy, it's just hard to know.
Yeah. In the book, you often refer to fairy tales and happy endings and princesses. I think that's mostly in the storyline around Najila and her hope that she will be able to get her father's permission to be with this man that she has talked to Abby about. His name is Lars. But I was struck by the fairy tale references, the happy ending references, how she wants to be a princess, and that all of that up against the events and the horrors that are happening around them. Was this intentional, your juxtaposition of these ideas?
It was, and I think that because even today there are women who, and that's not a bad thing, I suppose, women who really want that, the fairy tale.
Mm-hmm.
The Princess Kate wedding, and it doesn't mean that we're immune to all of the bad stuff, but I do think that dream still exists.
Yeah.
That Cinderella happily ever after doesn't juxtapose well with reality. But
well, one other aspect of the book, when Abby and Nick are talking to girls and young women who have escaped from sexual slavery or from the human trafficking, these girls often insist to the people talking to them that they are good girls.
Mm-hmm.
They're very adamant that people understand that they're good girls. So why did you have that be such a focus for them?
I think because part of the research that I did was to go online and to watch on PBS and CNN some of the documentaries and the interviews young women. And while they didn't come out and say it, they had such an innocence about their faces. And I thought that they are kids. And they want people to see them as that. So that was my projection onto them, that they wanted people to know they were good girls. And in that society, that would be important. If I'm a bad girl, it's not because I wanted to be.
Right. How much time did you spend researching this book before you started writing it? Or were you writing and doing research sort of at the same time?
I was writing and doing research at the same time.
And where were you? Were you in the States when you wrote this, or were you away?
I was here.
Okay. Are you here mostly now, or are you still going back?
I am here mostly now.
Okay.
Although I've been asked a couple of times to go away on missions. I can't go for long periods anymore, so it's harder. But I do hope to get back overseas soon. It really is the most rewarding. I know it sounds sappy. The most enriching, rewarding thing I've ever done in my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it doesn't sound sappy. I mean, particularly having read about some of this, it just seems like it really is. It would be terribly difficult and probably just such a cultural shock, but also just really rewarding, it seems like.
Yeah.
It would be. Yeah. What are you working on now, Roberta?
Well, my third novel is called Next of Kin, and it's a little different from my other ones in that it's the story of a foreign-born orphan who grew up in the foster system in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, she becomes a nurse, she's a travel nurse, and it's her search for a home and a family for Christmas.
Mm. And where is she from? Like, foreign-born from where?
Sylvia, Georgia.
Oh, okay. So you must be following the news very closely lately with all of the changes to...
Oh, I am.
What's allowed, yeah. I was also going to just ask you a little bit about what you like to read.
I love to read. I just finished a book called The Lifeboat by Charlotte Rogan.
Okay.
I
think I've heard about that.
It's fabulous. It's a story of a Titanic-like luxury liner disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And the group of people who were set on a lifeboat, and the tragedy that ensues, and the best and worst qualities of humanity are brought out. And it starts with one of the survivors who's on trial for her life. So it's an intriguing, incredible mystery and a great chronicle of human nature. Oh, it's just fabulous. Just loved it.
Okay, great. Anything else that you're reading right now?
I just started Dennis Lehane's Shutter Island.
Oh, okay.
And I love, so you can tell my reading is different. Shutter Island, anything by Dennis Lehane is terrific. Gone Baby Gone, and I just love his stuff.
Now, I can tell from having dialed your phone number that you're in Boston. You sound maybe like you're from Boston. Are you from Boston?
I am. Can you tell from my wicked cool accent?
So, do you enjoy reading the regional stuff by Dennis Lehane? He gets it all just right, doesn't he?
Yeah, he definitely does. I do enjoy the regional stuff, and I make sure in my stories that I put in some Boston stuff. But I have to say, my next novel is based mostly in Chicago.
Oh, wow. Now, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Have you spent a lot of time there?
I've spent a little. I definitely have to go back just to trace the neighborhood that my character lives in. And, but she's drawn to Chicago because of the movie Home Alone. Because as a child, that was a movie that really saved her life.
Okay.
You know, watching that, a kid alone who does okay in the end.
Yeah.
She wants to go to Chicago to see that house that guided her through so many sad Christmases.
Right. Oh, that's interesting. That's fun. I wanted to mention that your first acknowledgement in the bracelet, you have your acknowledgements right up front before the book starts.
Mm-hmm.
And your first acknowledgement goes out to your agents. You have two agents, it looks like. And this struck me because usually somebody will tuck an agent into the acknowledgement somewhere, but this was your very first acknowledgement. So you must have a great working relationship with your agents.
I love my agents. And as every writer who's out there knows, sometimes getting an agent is harder than writing your book. It really is the first step to getting published. It's so hard to get an agent. People think that you write a book and you bring it to a publisher. It's not so. You have to really go through the mill to find agents. And I am really, really lucky. I have just two fabulous agents who are friends now as well as agents.
Yeah. Are they in Boston? Are they in New York or somewhere else?
No, they're in New York.
Okay. How did you find your agents?
Well, I went through the internet like so many people do. I actually had written a nonfiction book first and had finally got an agent that I liked. He called me to New York. He said a publishing house loved my stuff and they wanted me to come down. Oh, my God, I was thrilled. It was the thrill of my life. I'm going to lunch in New York with the big boys. And I got down there, and the publishers were wonderful, but they wanted some changes to the story, and I had no idea what they were talking about. And my agent, because we didn't get a contract that day, kind of lost interest and became a jerk.
Oh, no.
And another friend told me to fire him. And I said, are you kidding? And he said, fire him. So I did. And then I wrote a novel, and that friend helped me to get my agent.
Okay. So your friend had a relationship with these people as well, or?
Yeah. Okay. And not professional. He knew one of them. And I really was reluctant. I thought, you can't email or call somebody and say, oh, your friend Mark told me I should call you.
Yes, you can.
But I did, and then the rest is history.
Now, did that first nonfiction book ever find a home?
No, and then the publishing house still periodically, they've emailed me to congratulate me on both the books, and they do ask, how's it coming? And I say, well, I actually haven't done anything with it yet.
Oh, okay.
So it might be the light of day yet.
Yeah, all right, interesting. Just getting back to the bracelet and to that storyline for a minute, I really liked Nick's philosophy. He at one point in the book, he says, help when you can, but don't pat yourself on the back for doing what you should do. I really loved that moment and that idea. So I guess my last question for you, Roberta, is what do you advise that Westerners should do to you know, we can't all be aid workers, but what should we do to help, if anything?
Yeah, I think there's a lot that people can do. Some of the biggest things are they can just keep their eyes open. Look for people. If we have clear eyes and an open heart, maybe somebody will come to us. Mm-hmm. And for background information, we can get involved by going to notforsale.org or the Polaris Project online and just getting some of the hard facts and just paying attention to it. It's hard sometimes not to let our eyes glaze over when news becomes too much. But if we keep our eyes open and our hearts open, I think that we can help and make a difference. I really mm-hmm. think that we can. It's an awful problem that does affect all of us.
It's a very shocking... It's shocking to read about it and to understand that this is happening and it's so widespread and that it's growing mm-hmm. fast. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, I'll just mention again, the book is The Bracelet by Roberta Gately, and the publisher is Gallery Books, which is Simon & Schuster imprint. So thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Roberta Gately. You can learn more about her work at robertagately.com. Her recent op-ed, Human Trafficking Solutions Are Here If We Look For Them, appeared on the website Take Part. I will put a link to that and to other helpful resources pertaining to human trafficking on my podcast site. Write the Book is brought to you by VCAM, with a mission to enrich civil discourse in the Chittenden County region by providing local citizens with access to training and state-of-the-art digital media tools as a means of personal, political, and artistic self-expression. More information at vermontcam.org. This week's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Roberta Gately. She says that when you observe people closely, writing ideas will naturally come to you. She suggests that writers always have a notebook handy so that you can jot down your ideas wherever you are, no matter what you're doing. And secondly, go to a place where you're likely to find a lot of people and a place where you can sit and observe without being too conspicuous. So she suggests a supermarket, a library, or a shopping mall, for example. Just watch people. See what you see and write down your ideas. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. Write the Book has a Facebook page. If you're a Facebook user, please like us. It's called Write the Book Radio Show, actually. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. I am now accepting submissions of writing prompt outcomes for possible inclusion on the show. If you go to the podcast site, you'll see submission guidelines for that. If you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, or if you have a writing prompt to suggest, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. You can also send me ideas for guests who you'd like to hear interviewed, writers who you are particularly interested in, who you'd like me to try to interview. I just got an email about one of those today, which was great. I'm hoping that I can talk to that person. So feel free to send me all of those ideas and suggestions. writethebook@gmail.com. The Radiator 105.9 FM WOMMLP is a community station. It's here thanks to volunteers and thanks to community support and involvement. More information is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont.